This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Once upon a time in America, began an article in Sunday's Washington Post magazine, there was a political party that believed in a strong central government, was popular on the college campuses of New England, and was the overwhelming choice of African-American voters. It was the Republican Party. To counterbalance the Republicans, there was a party that believed in low taxes, limited government, and was particularly suspicious of Eastern elites, the Democrats. In the article, staff writer David Vondrely noted that our two parties have completely swapped platforms over time, and if history holds true, they may well do it again. Even more intriguingly, he argues that once a party achieves a position of dominance, the Republicans after the Civil War, the Democrats after the New Deal, it overreaches and self-destructs. Later in the program, a snapshot of this year's campaign with the latest opinion polls, but first the rise and fall of political parties. For the next several minutes, we're going to be talking about history, the evolution of ideologies, and the migrations of various interest groups. If you have questions about those issues, give us a call now at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can zap us an email, TOTN at NPR.org. Later in the show, experts on today's political parties will join us to talk about what's happening now and what may happen in the months and years ahead. First, though, David Vondrely, a senior staff writer for The Washington Post, is with us here in Studio 3A. His article on political parties, Origin of Species, appeared in Sunday's Washington Post magazine. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Great to be here, Neil.
Going back to the American Revolution, what you describe as a kind of life cycle of what's almost always been a two-party system.
We started out, there was an idea in the heads of great men like George Washington that we wouldn't have parties at all, that this republic that they were starting in this new found land would be above faction. That didn't even last long enough to get the doors of the government open. The two really most brilliant young leaders of this government saw the future of the country completely differently. Alexander Hamilton perceived a nation that would be a great mercantile power, concentrated in great cities with finance and stock exchange and central banking and really sort of the world we have. Thomas Jefferson imagined a different sort of a country that would be much more led by agrarian statesmen, that would have a very weak central government, and the ties between the states would be he said it, that government is best that governs least. And these two men were so charismatic, so brilliant, that they formed factions around them, and eventually we got our parties with Washington kicking and screaming.
Jefferson's faction, the Democrats, they actually called themselves the
Republicans.
Yes. And then the Democrat Republicans?
And they had it both ways, and eventually along came Andrew Jackson, our seventh president, who really was a Democrat. Famously opened the doors of the White House after his inauguration to any muddy-booted ruffian who wanted to come in and have a look around, and they came in and walked on the sofas and tore down the drapes, and that really scandalized some of the more patrician members of the party, and so they went off and in their offense at the sort of overreaching, as they saw it, of Jackson, started a party called the Whigs, which wasn't very effective, but it was the beginning of the unraveling of the Democratic stranglehold or lock on the early government, and gave us the first in this cycle of collapses of the dominant parties.
And the Republicans, of course, came on as, to some degree, ancestors of the Whigs. Abraham Lincoln arrived, as you say, just in time.
Just in the nick of time.
And then the Republicans dominated certainly national politics, for the next 40 years?
Right. Yeah. And yet they what had held them together, which was a vision of strong central government, high taxes, mainly in the form of protective tariffs, obviously the using the federal government to end slavery and hold the union together, but also using the government to build infrastructure, the railroads, improve the banking system, the central currency, in every way to build up this industrial power. That did fine until around the turn of the century. Theodore Roosevelt comes along, and all of a sudden, big business, which had always favored a strong central government, began to think maybe they didn't want a strong central government because Teddy Roosevelt wanted to use this government power to regulate business. And the Republicans early in the 20th century had to choose between being the party of big business and the party of big government, and ultimately the business Republicans won out, and that created an opportunity for the Democrats to come roaring back.
And throughout this, there are a couple of sort of eternal issues that are disruptive and understandably disruptive throughout this process. One, of course, is the issue of race.
Yes. Race has been one of the central conundrums for America. I call America kind of a binary culture, which may explain part of the reason that we have two parties instead of many parties. You're either big government or small government. There's the famous North versus South split, the city versus country split in America. Something I call the prim versus frisky split, which for 100 years mainly had to do with whether you wanted to prohibit sale of alcohol, but
Dries or
nowadays
wets.
dries and wets. But now is more of an, has more to do with the below the belt sexual issues. But these themes have sort of divided us over the years. And what's intriguing is to watch the way a party will try to put together a coalition of these two-sided issues. So they might be, for a while, the big government, northern, pro-business city. Frisky party, but then something will drive that coalition apart, and the other party will try to pick up one of those pieces, and then they gain an advantage, but only for as long as they can keep these strange bedfellows under the same tent. So that we see Roosevelt, who was the greatest coalition builder probably in our history, create this amazing New Deal coalition. But as soon as the war ended, World War II, you had the conservative Southerners and populist rurals that were in his party, and the sort of liberal urban progressives that he had kept welded together through times of crisis. They immediately came apart as soon as the war was over in 1948.
And that coalition unraveled over the next, 35?
35 years. We've now seen it totally unraveled, and those Southern conservatives are in the Republican Party.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Right now we're talking with David Vondrely about, the evolution of these migrations of interest groups and the swapping of ideologies of these political parties. In a few minutes, we'll be talking about the political parties today, but let's talk history right now with Roy, who's with us on the phone from Warner, New Hampshire. Hello, Roy, you there? I think Roy is history, so it's, apparently has abandoned us.
Left our coalition.
And let's go instead with Jim. Jim is on the line from Bethesda, Maryland.
Yes, hi. I had a question about the role of the progressives in the early 1900s. How did they affect the ideologies of the Republicans and the Democrats? I know Teddy Roosevelt adopted some of the progressive ideals. What about the Democrats with William Jennings Bryan?
That's a classic example because progressivism was really kind of a new movement in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and there were a lot of
Jim has left us. Yeah, well, but thanks for the call.
A lot of progressive Republicans, and that's the direction Roosevelt wanted to take the party. In 1912...
And remember, he was an accidental president, the vice president who assumed office on the assassination of William McKinley.
That's right. So he hadn't really been vetted by the party powers. He voluntarily passed the office to his best friend, William Howard Taft, who, to Roosevelt's view, was too conservative and too much in the camp of the old McKinleyite Republicans. And so Roosevelt came out of retirement in 1912, challenged Taft for the Republican nomination.
And Bull Moose Party evolved.
Well, first he tried to be a Republican, and they chose Taft over Roosevelt, and then he ran as a third-party Bull Moose Progressive. But this was the moment when that that coalition came apart, where Roosevelt forced the party to choose between being progressive and being conservative. They chose conservative. That left the progressives to be picked up, swept up by the Democrats. And that was that paves the way for Roosevelt, the other Roosevelt.
Well, Woodrow Wilson was the immediate inheritor, as you point out, he was a progressive on some issues, but not on others.
Terribly reactionary on race in particular.
Okay, let's get another caller on the line. Harriet is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you. And I'd like to say, Mr. Conan, you do a wonderful job day after day after day. You are... So, you know, fast thinking, it's incredible.
Oh, well, here. Thank you so much.
Well, you really are. I'd like to say, don't you think that both the political parties at this time are taking regressive steps? For instance, if you're in Boston at this time and you're clear across the city from the convention center, nowhere near it, your bags can still be searched aboard a city bus. And if you're a protester, you have to go inside a protest pen and you're fenced in with razor wire. Now, isn't this completely anti to what Jefferson and Washington and all those people fought for as far as what we've been taught? What would they think about these things today? And isn't this sheer fascistic regression on both parties' part? Because we know that the Republicans aren't going to be any better with their convention. What do you think of this?
Well, David Vondrelli, I'll throw you that grenade.
I haven't seen it, so I can't comment firsthand. And
you haven't heard about it on the news?
Certainly, I've heard about it, and I regret that that the venues for protest are as...
that they're limited and that we're being searched?
I think I suspect the reason people are being searched is so that nobody will be blown up this week in Boston. And that's something that, you know, arguably Washington and Jefferson would not have wanted to happen either.
No, and dissent is being muffled within the convention itself. They're trying to keep it a very polite, not even anti-Bush convention.
Right.
We find this, many Democrats, we find this unacceptable, and we're extremely disenchanted with our party. And they might get our vote this election, but we're going quickly over to the Greens. This is a shame.
Harry, you may want to tune in tomorrow when this is going to be one of the subjects of our program tomorrow.
Great.
But let me ask David Vondrelli in the minute and a half we have left in this segment. I mean, and Harriet, thanks very much for the phone call, but what she's talking about is something quite common, which is that the national parties tend to try to move toward the center. Is that something, a phenomenon of the last few years, or does that go back to
that's forever. The with a two-party system, both parties are trying to win the middle because that's how they get the power that is what they're all about. And what Harriet is giving voice to is a wonderful example of how, even when you have a two-party system that on the surface appears unified, you have these competing factions and within the coalitions. And so I would expect, indeed, if the Democrats come to power, that some of these internal disputes that are muffled right now will come back to the fore, as I talk in the piece about potential areas where the Republican coalition could crack up.
David Vondrelli of The Washington Post. We're talking about the evolution of political parties. When we come back from a break, we'll be joined by experts on the Republican and Democratic parties today and talk about where they are in this life cycle of evolution. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the ideological and constitutional evolution of today's political parties. Our guest is David Vondrely, who wrote an article in last week's Washington Post Sunday magazine called Origin of Species. If you're a Republican, a Democrat, an Independent, a Libertarian, give us a call and tell us how the party system works for you. Have you ever switched parties? Call and tell us why. The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. And joining us now to take a look at where the Republican and Democratic parties stand today, and if they need to evolve, and if they are evolving, Rui Teixeira, the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the Century Foundation, co-author of The Emerging Democratic Majority. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Good to have you back on the program.
Great to be here.
And Todd Lindbergh, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, editor of Policy Review, joins us from the studios at Stanford Video in California. And welcome to you.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be here.
And I know you've both read David Vondrely's article. Do you recognize your political party in it? Todd Lindbergh, let's begin with you.
I think David's article is absolutely essential reading for these especially partisan times as we queue up for a national election. It's important, I think, for people not to get too carried away in their rooting interest to the point at which they forget that American politics is not about the success or failure of one party or the other party, but rather is about the kind of yin and yang, about the give and take back and forth between the two, and the way in which they try to position themselves to make this appeal to the middle, away from their ideological extremes. And I think that is a very important American story.
And now a savage attack from Rui Teixeira.
Well, I hate to disappoint, but I actually more or less agree with that. I think that, by and large, parties are vehicles for trying to serve the national interest, and they try to, you know, convince voters that they're serving their interest. And it's a very complex dance. And over time, as David points out, the parties could even change places in terms of their position. So at any given time, one has to look at the parties and evaluate them with that metric. That said, I think at this current time, I would say, you know, I tend to root for the Democrats, not because I would root for the Democrats at all times and places, but rather at this time, I feel they best represent where the nation is going, and I would argue even what people want, what public opinion reflects. So in that sense, I root for the Democrats. But if the Republicans turned around tomorrow and did something completely different than they are, you know, I'd consider rooting for them. I'm just not holding my breath.
Let's get an email question here from Jim. Isn't this switching of party ideology an invitation to corruption, which is inherent in a system where two parties dominate? Todd?
Well, I don't know about this corruption so much. Yeah, there's a lot of money that sloshes around in this country, and there are a lot of very serious interests. But I think both of the parties by now are actually pretty well funded by this. In fact, you know, you could say that that is the essence or an important part of the essence of the Ralph Nader complaint, namely that that both parties have been taken over in that sense by these special interests. But, you know, the special interests are another way of talking about those special interests is, you know, the business that gets done in America, the economy. And I think no one will praise the campaign finance system in this country, even now that it has been reformed. But at the same time, you know, there are big issues at stake. And I think it's more than merely a tale of corruption. It's also a tale of prosperity and of how people make their livings and of their ability to support their families.
David Vondrely, let me ask you. Publish in your article a litany of the flaws of these two political parties and some of the things that they've led to, gridlock, just to name one. But you also suggest, as Todd Lindbergh was just pointing out, that they may be doing some things right.
Well, one of the things Todd suggests we evaluate by, I think, is valid, which is has the United States done pretty well over the long run? And I think most people would say yes to that. I'm always moved by the observation that our two-party democracy is the worst possible form of government except for all the other ones. And so when you say that you don't like a two-party system, You have to either like a multi-party system, as we see in many European countries, or the other alternative is a one-party system. And if there is any lesson of the 20th century, it's that ideological purity in a single party coming to power is the worst possible thing that can happen to a country, as the Germans learned, as the Russians learned, as the Chinese learned, as the Cambodians learned, and on and on. So the fact that our parties are soulless, pragmatic, hold no principles above victory, in a way, is a good thing for us.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Sue, who joins us from Indianapolis.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call today.
Sure.
In Indiana, it's pretty much a given Republican state, which is a sad thing. But I used to be, from the time I was 18 until my mid-30s, I was a registered Republican. I found it to be very convenient, even though I would be considered liberal of my views, to be able to start the conversation with, I'm a registered Republican. And suddenly, I would be given credence to what I had to say.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment that I switched my party affiliation, the same people I'd have conversations with, suddenly I was really liberal. And I have a problem with that. I think the polarization between parties is a very, very sad thing for America in general.
Well, Rui Teixeira, one of the things that Sue gets to do that, as a registered Republican, is vote in some of the primary contests in her state that are, as she says, Indiana, not too many Democrats elected out there.
Well, true, though there is Evan Bayh, but certainly they're not going to go Democratic in a presidential election anytime soon. You know, I guess I find myself never quite as moved as I sort of have a sense I'm supposed to be by the concept that we're polarized. This is what happens periodically, that the parties become polarized. And if they have different viewpoints and if the country is split fairly closely on some of the things with which they're identified, what on earth is wrong with polarization? And what is wrong with polarization in a situation in which, arguably, you have a conservative Republican administration which really wants to push the policy agenda in a way that doesn't really comport that well with a good chunk of the country, including some of the people who vote for them? What's wrong with a little polarization in that context and a little gridlock to prevent them from doing the things that they really want to do? What would be desirable to see that polarization reduced and that gridlock broken in such a way that we would move toward the kind of policies that most people would support? And again, I think you can make the argument from public opinion data at this point that Democrats are actually more identified with those policies than the Republicans. So if the Democrats in the next few years manage to develop a working majority, take back the presidency, and push some things through, that would certainly break gridlock, but not in this kind of diffuse good government, oh, why can't everybody just get along way that people seem to have such attraction to these days, and which I rather doubt will ever happen, frankly.
Sue, thanks. Was there one issue that pushed you, by the way, to change your registration?
Well, I was asked to start working within the Democratic Party, and I was going to become a precinct committeeman, and I switched my party affiliation until I found out that under particular policies of the committeeman I was going to be working under, he wanted me to work for all the candidates, whether I liked them or not, within the party.
Ah.
I found that to be a little bit too much the other direction for my taste.
So you think about going back?
Yes. I believe the next primary, I will be switching my party affiliation back to the Republican Party, so I can start being listened to again within my state.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Sue.
Well, thank you. You have a great show.
Todd, you were trying to get in there?
Well, yeah, I think that's very interesting, you know, because not only are there two parties, which in general gravitate toward different political positions, and, you know, Rui and I will have an ongoing conversation about which is more representative, broadly speaking, of American public opinion in general, which we should probably continue. But nevertheless, within each party, there are also two wings. It's one thing to say that the Republican Party wants to push a broadly conservative social agenda, which I think is the point that Rudy was just making. And to some degree, that's true, because there is a faction within the Republican Party and a very consequential faction that feels very strongly about these social issues, about issues of identity, politics, and so forth. But that's not the whole of the Republican Party. And there are a lot of Republicans at the moment who are not especially comfortable with those kinds of issues, who would like, for example, the issue of gay marriage to disappear, who, on the contrary, as opposed to feeling obliged to amend the Constitution, would like very much to live and let live on the issue. So you have within the party this dynamic that also develops. And it's a question of accommodating those members of the party who have this strong sense of identity, politics, of the conservative social issues, et cetera, versus the more libertarian-leaning segments of the party, the more internationalist in outlook, that sort of thing. And I would say that the same thing is true in the Democratic Party as well. You've got a staunchly progressive wing associated maybe with the labor movement, among other constituent groups. And then you've got the more centrist Clinton-developed Democratic Leadership Council, kind of New Democrat wing, which thinks that that it needs to be listened to in crafting a broad appeal to Americans. In other words, I think that there are elements of both parties that are quite out of the mainstream. But again, it is not only the yin and yang between the two parties, but also within the parties that in which they try to strike a balance that has this potential for a successful appeal to a majority of voters.
Let's get another caller in. Dane joins us from Carlton, Minnesota.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air, Dane. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted just to ask... isn't the Republicans on the verge of causing that black hole effect of gathering too much power and becoming hated by the American people to the point of collapse? At this time, it seems like it's awful close.
Well, let's ask Todd Lindbergh. You talked about the strains within the Republican Party, also in the Democratic Party. But is the Republican Party still in the ascendant and still gathering momentum? It's certainly been doing certainly since Ronald Reagan was elected, and or is Dane right, and is it on the verge of a schism?
Well, you know, things tend not to be quite as once and for all as all that in American politics. I mean, there are exceptions, but I don't know. I mean, ask me the second week in November, and I think we'll have a little more evidence on the table. And certainly there's some indications of strain, but a lot of those strains have something to do with national, international events as well as the possible internal contradictions of the Republican Party.
Absolutely. Can I just say one quick thing?
Go ahead, Dane.
They have Osama, but we got Obama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Dane. We're talking with David Vondrelli of the Washington Post, also with Rui Teixeira and with Todd Lindbergh. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from National Public Radio News. And let's continue the conversation. Rui, you wanted to get in here?
Yeah. On this momentum issue about who's sort of in the ascendancy, I think you can actually make a pretty good case that at this point the momentum is definitely in favor of the Democrats. The Republicans would not be in the position they're in today without two events that occurred that played to their traditional, what remains of their strengths. One is the Clinton scandals, which basically got Bush into office initially, and the second thing was 9/11. Which played to their perception of being stronger in national security issues. Now, the Clinton scandals thing is gone. We're now several years past 9/11, and the advantage that the Republicans had in national security issues, including the war on terror, has diminished rather radically. And that's one reason why Kerry is so competitive in this election. You look at all the public opinion trends and how they're moving. Look at party ID trends. Democrats now actually have now have regained the advantage they had on party ID prior to 9/11.
We should note, Rui, the author of The Emerging Democratic Majority, making his case there. Let's get another caller on the line. Brad is with us from Sterling, Illinois.
Yeah. My question is, with all the modern things they have, like polling and...
modern things they have. Brad, we're losing you.
Yeah, with all the modern things like polling and districts, I can't imagine them losing power too much because they know what the people are thinking even before the people think it.
A lot of these computer databases that are playing such an important part in research for this election, and you could throw into that mix the redistricting, which has given so many members of the House of Representatives of both political parties safe seats that really aren't competitive. Maybe more competitive races in the U.S. Senate this year than there are in the House of Representatives. Did you have a comment on that, Todd Lindbergh?
Yeah, I think this this process by which we essentially make House races entirely uncompetitive. I mean, the number of House seats that are truly competitive in this country is in the double digits, and not high in the double digits, maybe 30. Is, I think, really very dangerous for this country over time. I think that promotes a certain amount of congressional arrogance on one hand and a kind of decadence on the other. I'd really like to see something done about that. I agree also that it's interesting how, if you look at reelection rates, the Senate is a far, far more competitive body these days than the House seems to be. So I don't think that's good. And I sure wish I could think of a solution to it. And unfortunately, I can't. I think the best solution, by the way, would probably be if we had not restricted the growth in the size of the House of Representatives early in the 20th century. If we'd allowed that to continue to grow as population grew, so that rather than having districts representing 700,000 Americans or so, you still maintained a much lower ratio. In that case, you'd have maybe 800 members of the House of Representatives now. Now, it would make for a somewhat unwieldy body, but on the other hand, it would make for a more representative body.
And you don't represent the construction lobby on Capitol Hill.
Right.
David Von Draley, I want to give you the last word and go back to the last word that you used in your article, and we going back to that bitter divide between the Federalists and the Democrats, and the resolution that came to that when two bitter enemies finally, after at long last, resolved their many disagreements, or if not resolved their disagreements, at least managed to see some more interests than divisions.
Well, I love that story because it's the tale of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson late in their lives, long after they had clashed in 1800 in one of the most bitterly partisan divisive elections in our history. And they basically remembered what it was that they had fought together for, what principles they had sacrificed for when they wrote the Declaration of Independence together in 1776. And by a weird stroke of the screenwriter of history, they died the same day, and it was the 4th of July in the 1820s. And as he was dying, Adams said, "Jefferson still lives." And that spirit that we share more than there is to divide us is it's a hopeful note.
David Von Draley of The Washington Post, thank you very much. Our thanks also to Rui Teixeira, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress and the Century Foundation, and to Todd Lindbergh, a fellow at the Hoover Institution and editor of Policy Review. When we come back, the latest polls in the presidential election. Call us and get in on that conversation. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News.